July Tynwald was not only a lengthy affair, but also jam-packed with interesting debates. We'll hear later from Ministers Barber, Kane and Poole Wilson about a lack of success in meeting carbon reduction, possible efficiencies and improvements in education, and an A-star for the Chief Constable's report. Chris Thomas gives a D- to Tynwald for not allowing him to move a debate on a significant change in housing policy, but first, Joni Farragher led a very thoughtful debate on the position the Isle of Man should take on international law.
You had a couple of motions. The first one had pretty much moved a couple of the contributors to tears, and that was in relation to, I suppose, to summarise, the fact that the Isle of Man should be speaking up, particularly Tynwald should be speaking up when it sees things happening internationally which it doesn't agree with.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, kind of. What I was really asking was for a written communication to be made to the UK government from Tynwald Parliament, which expressed that we don't think that they should provide defence support or intelligence for countries credibly alleged to be committing war crimes or crimes against humanity. So it didn't reference any specific situation. It just asked for a kind of principled stance, I suppose. However, the Council of Ministers brought an amendment. And as you'd said, Phil, you know, people, it was quite an emotive debate. It was quite charged, which was actually really, it wasn't good to see. That's not the right word. But I was buoyed, I think, to see that people were emotionally invested in this issue, because actually it really is one that we should all be invested in, and that we should all have some part of our attention being paid to it. Obviously, people were talking about the situation in Israel and Gaza. And that I did, as I did mention, that speaks more to that reality of that situation, because my motion didn't reference any country or situation in the world today. So the fact that everybody's minds immediately went to that, I think, speaks absolute volumes. And with members being quite emotional about the scenes that we've been witnessing, which have been harrowing, absolutely harrowing is really the only word that we could use to describe that, I think. So it had, you know, it had made some people very emotional, which is right, absolutely right in this situation. The Council of Ministers had an amendment, which, as I say, did specifically reference the situation in the Middle East, and did reaffirm our alignment with international law, which is good. It had some merits, but of course it did strip out the requirement for the Chief Minister to write to the UK government, which I think is just a huge missed opportunity for our Parliament to actually take a mature and prudent and principled stand.
And there were several other amendments. One suggested that maybe the president of Tynwald could write on behalf of Tynwald, and then it's, I suppose, taking that anxiety of government to government related communication away. But that wasn't supported either, was it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was actually supported in Keys, but it wasn't supported in the Legislative Council, presumably with the president kind of being the leader of the Legislative Council, if you want to put it in those terms. So it's a shame that that amendment failed because of the disagreement of the Houses. But yeah, I mean, I would have been comfortable with anybody writing, really, and do intend to take some action in that area myself.
So basically you're going to write to somebody?
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be a group of people who will wish to put their names to a letter. And you know, that could include other political parties as well. So at this stage, it's not nothing set in stone. But I think there is a lot of will to make that sort of, it's a symbolic gesture, and we are all aware of that, and we do lots of symbolic gestures as parliaments. But it's a cautious and careful but in its heart a very principled approach to take, in my view.
And why do you suppose that government seems so concerned not to have to write on this particular issue? I mean, I think you referenced in your speech that we were quick enough to respond on the Russia-Ukraine situation. Why do you think specifically on the Palestine-Israel position, government is loath to comment?
It's a tough question, isn't it, really? I think the answer revolves around political allegiances, really, and the fact that Israel is a Western-aligned government. And this is the first time, really, I think, that the Western world has been called to apply the rules-based order of the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, because this is the first time ever that a Western-aligned leader in Benjamin Netanyahu has had an arrest warrant put out for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I would ask the question, have we stepped up to our responsibility, actually, in light of the fact that this was the first time that we've been tested? Have we stepped up to that?
And, well, I suppose then answer your own question.
Well, no.
That's a fair answer. So what we've ended up with basically then is a position statement of Timrod.
Yeah, that's right. And like I said, it's definitely not without its merit. It's a good position statement in many ways. I'm disappointed to see that it takes out the requirement to contact the government of the United Kingdom about it, because I feel like that is our responsibility. As I referenced several times, it is our responsibility under customary international law, that places all parliamentarians under a responsibility, actually, and the provisional measures by the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, did trigger or engage that responsibility, I suppose, for all countries, regardless of size, regardless of constitutional status, to take actions to prevent genocide. Have we done that? It would be my question. I've tried to do that by asking our parliament to express that our view is that we shouldn't be providing any form of defence support or intelligence support to countries that are credibly alleged by recognised international organisations, the highest legal authority in the world, to be committing war crimes. So that, I feel like we've had the debate and it's been a good debate, and it was engaged with respectfully, and like I said, it did elicit many emotional responses, which was right and apt under the circumstances. I just do wish that we had retained the requirement to write to the United Kingdom government, and I think that will be something that members will look back on with sincere regret when the day of reckoning arrives.
The Isle of Man has its own international personality agreement, which was agreed, I think, back in the time Tony Brown was chief minister, and that effectively allows the Isle of Man to effectively steer its own course on the international stage. Writing to the UK is one thing, perhaps writing to the warring parties in the Middle East is something else that should be being considered.
Perhaps, yeah. I mean, it's certainly a good suggestion. I think my point was that we all have our spheres of influence. We all have the areas that we can pull levers in, and the areas which are outside of our sphere of influence. In my view, our sphere of influence is very much with the fact that we have a constitutional relationship with the UK that sees us as respectful partners. That's the United Kingdom's words from many, many reports and statements that they've issued on their constitutional relationship with the Crown Dependencies. So as respectful partners, I think it's right for us to show that constructive criticism and say, you know, can you just check that you are aligning yourself with your international obligations on our behalf?
And you mentioned there the Channel Islands. I think Jersey has made a clear position known to the UK government.
Indeed, and they expressed that opinion to the UK government via their external relations minister. So for whatever reason, the Council of Ministers have not felt that we can do the exact same thing that Jersey did. I think that reason will probably be lost in the mists of time, because it might be a personal issue with that that's not been expressed over this debate. What was expressed was that it wouldn't be appropriate for us to do that, which is clearly not the case, because there is precedent for this. So when we can see that two things have been, something's been said that is clearly not true, because it doesn't compare with a precedent that exists, we have to kind of draw our own conclusions, and that's all we can do in this scenario as to why the Council of Ministers have decided we couldn't do that.
You had another motion, and that was in relation to the Park Road site and the desire, certainly amongst the Douglas members, if my reading of the debate was correct, to have a replacement school built there.
Yeah, that's right. So as most people will be aware, the Park Road site was demolished over 12 years ago and remains vacant, very sadly, you know, this sort of prime piece of land right in the heart of Douglas East, really. And I thought that I could kind of marry up two sort of constituent issues that I receive regular correspondence about, which was that there is a vacant site on Park Road, and secondly, that the parents of children in Skull and Jubilee, particularly the junior site, you know, kind of give their views that the school needs modernisation, that the resource isn't kind of quite appropriate for modern teaching, and the condition of the building is poor. So I thought if I put forward that motion, obviously in the process of the Council of Ministers and the relevant departments looking as to how they could respond to my motion, it's been discovered that it's not the desk that owned that land, it's the DOI. So that's hence the fact that Dr. Hayward had her amendment on behalf of the Council of Ministers to take out the requirement to use it as a primary school and just tasks the Council of Ministers with bringing forward a plan for development by February. At this point, I'm quite comfortable with that, simply because I know that the constituents are just extremely keen to get something done with that site, and it really has been very unfair on the residents in that area. But putting my constituency hat on, and I've said in my summary up, there's clear evidence that the replacement of Murray's Road is becoming urgent. There's a desperate need, really, for a new school. I don't want it to be outside of Douglas East. It's the only school that we do have in my constituency. I want my constituents to be able to drop their children close to them and to not have to be crossing main roads, etc., and not having to use cars. I want the needs of the residents to be taken into account, and I believe that the conclusion that you would arrive at if you do that is that we need that school there on that site. So I hope that the Council of Ministers go away and make the right decision.
That was Douglas East MHK Joni Farragher. DEFA Minister Claire Barber moved the Climate Change Transformation Progress Report and came in for some criticism during the debate.
Probably the most positive thing that was said in relation to the discussion about where government's at in relation to moving towards a zero carbon future is that the report was unscrupulously honest.
Absolutely, and I mean, this was an update report, so this was saying, where are we? What's the reality of the situation? And we know that some of those things are behind where we wanted to be, unquestionably. I'm not going to pretend that it's any different than that. But the reality is, I think we need that honesty, because that also then starts to force some of those actions. And the reality is, across government, this isn't DEFA doing this alone. I think that was drawn out well by Mr. Thomas. This has to be all departments playing their part. And we're seeing, you know, a lot of challenge, I suppose, around people trying to prioritise lots of other things that are going on. And absolutely, I understand that. And yet, time and again, all of the studies show that actually, in terms of cost of living, as a great example, climate change action makes sense.
And it does. I think the global ambition is to reach net zero by 2050, based on the 3.8% reduction that there has been since 2018, over that 5-year period to 2023, my basic maths worked out that at this rate, it's going to be 135 years before we reach net zero.
And of course, that relies on us looking at a graph that just goes down steadily on a slope, which isn't what our plan has ever shown. So we would have a sort of slow and steady start. And then when we do the electricity decarbonisation, there would be quite a significant drop. And then we go back to that sort of steady removal of carbon from our island. The reality is that, you know, that decarbonisation of the electricity is fundamental. That really is a key part, and also some of the work around the home heating, looking at how we, you know, phase out use of the gas and oil boilers, for example. But we also know there's complexities in some homes. So there really is a lot of work going on behind the scenes to look at how we manage some of those more complex elements of this, but also bringing in that big timeline around the electricity grid. And that will come with the energy strategy update, which is scheduled towards the end of this year.
Do you think you'd do better if you ditched the whole reference to carbon and actually just describe this as government driving through a more efficient and sustainable way of delivering heating energy for our lives?
So I think you make a really valid point, and it's interesting when we look at a lot of the wider programs, they are moving away from carbon neutral, net zero, climate change, and they are talking far more now about sustainability. The reality is they all are the same thing, but I'm finding myself really trying to lean in actually to those benefits. You know, when we look at the energy efficiency scheme or Green Living Grant scheme, you know, the significant benefit that people are actually interested in is that it reduces their bills, it stabilizes their bills, and it's far less about how much carbon they've saved in their home. That's not the reason people are doing it, because they have a much more clear picture of how much their bills are going to be, and they're reducing their reliance on external, you know, gas, which we know is volatile and has been significantly so. And when we look at the global, you know, geopolitical climate at the minute, I think there are some significant challenges that we've been through, we're still in, and I think it's absolutely right that we support people to make those changes, and that should be done by supporting those who've got the best advantages to doing that, but also who aren't able to facilitate that on their own, which is why we've put means testing into the schemes, and I think that's really important, actually.
Ministers, as was described in the debate, are effectively on the hook for this. The Climate Change Act is very clear. You know, the targets are in law, and effectively Council of Ministers is culpable if the targets aren't met. Judging on this update report, there's very little chance of you meeting these targets.
And I think it's interesting, because when we listened to the debate, of course, there was a mixture between you're accountable, which I acknowledge, we should change the targets. Again, I take the position people are coming from, but I also think it's really imperative to have targets to force action. So when these targets were brought in, they were hugely ambitious, but equally, they are there statutorily present, and they are absolutely the things we're working towards. What I don't think would be right would be for us to undermine, for example, the planning system, for us to undermine those wider processes that is absolutely right we go through to make sure we make the right decisions for the future. And sometimes, of course, those things are very tricky, and that you can't determine how long they'll take. We certainly know with planning, things can take a significantly long period of time. And if you go through an appeals process, potentially dolience processes, you know, it really can go on for years. So some of those things are out of our hands, but it's right, I believe it's right that we have those processes in place to make the right decisions. So it's particularly difficult, I suppose, when some of those big projects that are the most reliant on those big processes that can take longer are the things that will make the significant differences and allow us to reach the targets. So I think it's right to have the targets. And I said, you know, if people want to bring a motion back, we had one in December that wasn't supported. What's really, I think, great to hear is that actually there is a wide support for climate change. And I think what we need to do as the climate team, and I've already reached out, we've already had conversations within the team, but off the back of the debate today, we've already agreed, you know, I think we need to go and spend more time with the departments, both with the officers and the politicians, and look at how we unpick some of the blockers that appear to be there and make sure we deliver true climate action for the island.
One of the criticisms that you also had was in relation to the bureaucracy. And I suppose on the one hand, if you set yourselves targets, you have to be able to demonstrate that you've achieved those targets. But it would appear, certainly from my perspective as a clerk to a local authority, that we're so busy now filling in forms and checking to see what we've done from one year to another. But there doesn't seem to be the same level of impetus behind coming up with long-term solutions to change.
Well, I can assure you the team are absolutely on the case with the long-term solutions for change, and there's a huge amount of work going on behind the scenes, you know, with a relatively small team, but absolutely committed. And I really want to put on record, and I did in the court, my thanks to the team, because you know, their commitment to this is absolutely unwavering, and I think that's been really valuable. But in terms of the paperwork, I think we can see that, because actually at the other end of you submitting it is someone on the team who's sitting going through it and making sure it's inputted correctly, who's coming back with questions. So I think where we can reduce that, where we can make that more streamlined, that's absolutely what we want to do. But equally, there are some things where our reporting standards are set by organisations that are bigger than us, and we've got to make sure that what we put in is accurate, because otherwise this thing we get out at the end, you know, it's only as good as the data you input at the beginning. But where we're asking parties to do that also, we're very keen to work with bodies. If people have got questions, we absolutely are open to having discussions about how we can support. And we know that's been trickier for some organisations than others. But we, you know, the team would always welcome people coming forward and asking questions, and they will happily help or direct you in the point of someone who can.
And final question then, when do we expect the next update report? Because there was a little bit of discussion about whether it should be in December or whether July or whether, well, actually July, Tim was looking as though it's certainly going to run into 4 days, might even go into a fifth day. So maybe June, Tim, I don't know. When is the next planned report?
So I think there's a number of things that are going to happen. The annual report is scheduled for July. If we need to move it around, and you know, acknowledging how heavy the order paper's been this year, then I'm happy to have that conversation. But on top of that, we've also got the energy strategy update that's going to be coming October, November this year is the aim. That will be coming for debate, and that will have the timeline around electricity decarbonisation. And then we'll also be starting that process around what the 27 plan will look like, because our current plan is 22 to 27. We'll need a 27 to 32 plan, and that will involve consultation with all the various bodies as well. So there's a number of touch points that are coming through where there'll be an opportunity both for Tynwald members but also the wider public to have their say and get involved.
That was Douglas East MHK Claire Barber. Home Affairs Minister Jane Poole Wilson had the happy job of receiving plaudits for a well-received Chief Constable's report.
Often, Chief Constable's report, when it's debated, the debate can run into several hours. It was a less lengthy debate. Members kept their comments relatively brief, but it's a reasonably positive report, would you say?
Yeah, I think it's a very positive report, actually. I think in terms of the detail, the reporting increase in crime detection rate, and I think the reduction in overall crime, I think is a really good news story. And when you start to dig in behind the various policing priorities set by the department and how the police have performed against them, you know, you do see high productivity and effectiveness. And as I said in the debate, you know, I take my hat off to our constabulary as a small, relatively small force. The way in which they multi-hat and the variety of work that they manage to cover is really quite impressive, particularly when you compare ourselves with neighbouring jurisdictions.
And of course, when you do those sorts of comparisons, we tend to compare ourselves with much larger areas that clearly have the ability to rely on several police forces that can combine in emergency situations. Obviously, on the Isle of Man, that's much less an availability for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think the Chief Constable actually alludes to that in this year's report, that although we do have mutual aid arrangements in place across all of our emergency services, actually, the reality is that water that surrounds us means that we have to try and make sure that we're in a position where we're efficient and effective in our staffing and equipment levels, but to build in a level of resilience that we can cope with the challenges that can face us. And listeners will be highly aware, although this report covered the year to the 31st of March 2025, listeners will be very aware of the fact that in recent months, not only did the Constabulary Police, the TT Festival, very successfully, but they had to deal with some really tragic and difficult situations around that time, which absolutely are incredibly sad and difficult for the community and require specialist work by the police and hours of work as well, not only to carry out the right level of investigation, but actually to support the community through what has been an incredibly difficult time.
I mean, you mentioned there the TT. One of the issues that clearly was raised this year was the use, some believe inappropriate use, of images of severe accidents. How could a situation like that happen? Surely to goodness, things like that need to be vetted in advance before you release those sorts of really harrowing videos.
So I did answer a question in the House of Keys on this matter, and I absolutely expressed my regret that happened. I completely understand why particularly families and those connected with people involved in those serious incidents would have been upset. I think, you know, the issue is that those matters are dealt with within the Constabulary, and I was also able to comment that learning has been taken away from that and processes reviewed, because yes, of course, no one wants to cause severe upset in that way, no matter what the good intent may be behind that type of public information.
And apart from a few issues like that, on the whole, most people living in the Isle of Man think that it's a safe place to live. We don't have significant crime on the island. That there is, though, the concern that perhaps organised crime may be seeing the Isle of Man as an opportunity.
So I think we've seen over the last few years the evolving nature of threat and risk to the island. I think you're absolutely right that the activity of serious and organised criminals has been recognised. And I would say that's exactly why we've worked so hard with the Securing Our Island strategy to be able to respond to that. And it's multi-layered. I think it's absolutely the right thing to make sure that we work with partners in the UK, which is the National Crime Agency and the North West Regional Crime Unit, that we use an intelligence-led approach, that we do what we've done, which is combining the Ports policing staff into the Isle of Man Constabulary, which gives us better operational resilience and also allows for better sharing of intelligence, that we work closely with Customs and Immigration, which again is an important way of really making best use of our resource, and that we use the Police Dogs Unit, which also has had huge success. And in fact, you will see from the Chief Constable's annual report that the number of disruptions have gone up significantly in the reporting year. But also, we want to provide a deterrent to those who would seek to try and exploit the island. And as part of our ongoing work, we have got the rollout now of automatic number plate recognition at the ports, which again is an important way of using intelligence to yield meaningful impact.
In a somewhat bizarre way, we can do that checking in terms of cars because they clearly have a number plate on them. It's more difficult to do that in terms of people because we don't have identity cards on the island, and yet we carry cards for pretty much everything. You know, we've got apps on our phones or cards that allow us to do banking, to do all kinds of things. But when it comes to identity cards, and this was something that Julie Edge called for in the discussion, I think, that we seem loath to go down that route.
So I think it is really interesting the point you raise, because I think the point was also made by Ms. Lord Brennan. It was in a separate debate, actually, but I think, you know, I think there is an understanding on the part of many islanders now. Certainly the conversations I've had at constituency level, but also at the recent Council of Ministers roadshows, you know, people really do value our safety and security. And I think there probably is a slight change in outlook now, that whereas once upon a time it probably would have been anathema to suggest that we might think about things like some sort of residency card or identity card. I think people can see that there may be benefits, and I think people have got used to having, as you say, many different apps and means of verification and so on. So I think that has moved, and I think it's absolutely right that we continue to debate these things and strike the balance between something we've always valued, which is our freedom and our freedom of movement within the common travel area, but also recognising that there are proportionate and sensible things that we do to maintain our quality of life, and safety is an absolute bedrock of that.
But generally speaking, and going back to the actual report itself, you must be pretty pleased as Minister with the work that the Chief Constable and his force are doing.
I am, Phil. I think, you know, as I said, considering the size and the range of matters and the increasing complexity of some of the most serious criminality that has to be addressed, you know, and also the fact that we have introduced new legislation here, domestic abuse legislation, and we've modernised our sexual offences legislation, really important things to do. With that, though, goes rising reporting, which is also the right thing. I encourage, and I'm glad people come forward, but of course that increases the demand for the constabulary. It also increases the complexity of the types of investigation, and I have to say they have achieved above and beyond, and I wish them, the Chief Constable and the hard-working members of the constabulary and all of the staff and volunteers that work with them, continued success.
That was Middle MHK Jane Poole Wilson. In an extraordinary Tynwald procedure, Chris Thomas had a motion that was in order at the beginning of the sitting ruled out of order due to some changes in rules made during the sitting.
You had some fairly outspoken comments in relation to the Standing Orders Committee coming forward with a range of changes to standing orders. It's probably the most passionate speech I've heard you give for quite some time. You're obviously concerned about some of these changes.
I am. It's a constituency issue that drives one of them, and the other one's a personal issue to do with the mechanism that was used and the possibilities that were available to me when I was asked to stand down most recently, especially compared to how Laurie Hooper was treated in that situation. So if we go to the constituency issue, there is a huge planning application from the Manx Development Corporation, which has got substantial ramifications for parking for the constituents, but also for the provision of affordable housing, something that's very important to me. Government's been changing policy, or is it Manx Development Corporation that's been changing policy? So I put down a motion later on this sitting's order paper for us to discuss the policy around affordable housing, active travel, parking and the planning process itself. That's now been ruled out of order because of a change to standing orders. Basically, we're no longer allowed to discuss planning applications inside Tynwald Court.
And that in itself is quite unusual, I think, or strange, that things could be put onto the order paper and deemed to be in order, and then you change the rules subsequent to it being in order to make it out of order. Yeah. I mean, it's, you'd have thought they would have at least heard the items as you had been correctly laid on the order paper before introducing the new regulations.
I agree with that, but the even more important than that is we do need to discuss what the Department of Infrastructure Housing and Properties Officer has sent to the Planning Committee before they've made a decision about the site that is going to be used at Westmoreland Village for hundreds of houses in a new way, making them affordable, because they're not affordable by the current definition. We had the Minister of Cabinet Office and Chair of the Housing Communities Board, David Ashford, admit that yesterday.
And why do we need to know that?
Well, because the Isle of Man way is to have either local authorities or the DOI providing social housing or public housing, and then we have a shared equity scheme to enable first-time buyers and second-time buyers in exceptional circumstances to purchase housing. We're now innovating, which can be a good thing, but at the very least, the decision to innovate needs to be taken in Tynwald Court with the public knowing that we're doing this innovation, because there's now a possibility that DOI Housing Agency will be managing houses inside Douglas, which I imagine would be quite frightening to local authorities around the island. Even more likely, from my point of view, will be that a new housing association will be managing these properties. Second point is that the amount that will have to be paid by whoever is taking on these properties is more than is currently in law. So we changed what's called the shared equity scheme in Tynwald. This paper from DOI to the Planning Committee talks about a higher amount needing to be paid by whoever's operating. So effectively, it's more money transferred to the Manx Development Corporation to cover the build costs. Look, we haven't got time to go through all of the details, but we definitely need to have this discussion in the public. Manx Development Corporation has borrowed £20 million. £5 million has been put there as equity. It owns property now all around that site and in other places of Douglas that will reveal in future weeks. It's all public information. It's just we haven't got time for that in this interview, and that's a very major issue that should be discussed in Tynwald. And if it's not, unfortunately, we'll have to discuss it outside Tynwald, and the change today meant that we're not allowed to discuss it in Tynwald anymore, it seems, because it relates to a live planning application that in part
but in principle that's a reasonable thing. You know, you can't expect people who are decision makers effectively to prejudge their decision by having a political debate in a different place, in a very public place, which is Tynwald.
Yeah, conflicts of interest are really, really important, but we've got to establish the policy inside a political arena that's going to be used inside that decision-making process. And I describe some potential problems with the new standing order. The first one is I named a site, Lord Street site, that had a planning application on it, then it stopped having a planning application on it, now it's got a planning application again. So can a Tynwald debate take place in the months when there is no planning application on it, but not when there's an actual planning application? Presumably that's allowed. I then went in to extend that to the down south wind turbines and the territorial seas. They're already in a planning process. An application hasn't been made, but we're already preparing the documents for the planning application, and it's a matter of dispute about when the planning application should be made in those things. So
But they were talking about a live planning application, yeah. And as things stand, there is no planning application in relation to the Airystain wind farm.
Yeah, so you know, let's hope that if it's now my motion has been ruled out of order this month, I'll put it down for debate in October in a way that is acceptable under the new standing orders. But, and I think my way was, I disagree with the clerk's advice in that sense, but you know, my expectation now is that a decision will be made over the summer months. There are potential interested parties who could appeal, and that's where we are in terms of that live planning application. But I want to say my primary interest in all of this is to make sure that the people, all of us, know what's going on in terms of affordable housing policy, also parking policy. At one point, ADOI Minister Crookall indicated that there wouldn't be residence parking permits available for Westmoreland Village, including the former nurses' home and the Crookall House site. They are now being made available. Residents there do have parking permits, I think. And finally, today in the climate change progress report, we were told that active travel strategy is no longer being pursued, it seems. And this whole basis for this development in Westmoreland Village is around a 20-minute neighbourhood, a 15-minute city. That isn't happening at the moment. What's described in those statements isn't coming to fruition. So you could argue that the concepts submitted to the planning are out of date. Just leave you with one thought on this, which is that essentially a new document was submitted to the planning committee on 8th of May by the DOI housing officer. That was considered by the planning committee on the 19th of May. I found it on the website. I don't think Douglas City Council had found it because they didn't comment. It was just reported what their views were in discussions over the previous months. I don't think the objectors in that area had found it except for the ones to whom I brought it to the attention. And there are many, many more potentially interested parties and stakeholders who should have been involved in commenting on that document. So the suggestion that was made was that this effectively was a new document that should have a six-week, eight-week consultation period. That was that didn't happen. And that's quite a major thing. That's the sort of thing that could end up as the basis of an appeal, it seems to me.
That was Douglas Central MHK Chris Thomas. Finally, Education Minister Daphne Kane.
This was in relation to the funding review of schools report that was commissioned by the Council of Ministers before I was in post, actually. And it was honouring my commitment to return to Tynwald this month and give an update as to the progress over the past several months.
That report made quite a number of recommendations, including recommendations to get rid of the small primary schools, to merge them with larger primary schools, a whole raft of things that were potentially could have saved the department £1 million or more pounds. Any of that happening?
Well, as I said, in the initial report that came before Tynwald in July last year, and again in my update this year, pointed out that we as a department did not accept that finding, finding that the rationalisation of some of the smaller primary schools would, including some in Douglas as well as out of town, would make savings of over £3 million. And the department doesn't accept, because we value the role of the individual school within different communities, but you know, while they continue to deliver great educational outcomes, however, there's also an important piece of work that the department is undertaking that is the school utilisation survey, and that is how each part of each school is used. And also in conjunction with the Department of Infrastructure, they are undertaking condition surveys on all the school estate, and those two pieces of data will come together, and we will be looking at it very much in detail, also taking account of what planning for housing estates is has been zoned or announced or in development. And likewise with Paul Crane, MLC, member of the department, he has very in-depth knowledge of population data, and that is being fed into our review. So we have said that we don't want to close schools because they are small while they have a very good educational outcome, but of course we have to be responsible and ensure that the school system that we have best meets the needs of all our learners in all those places, and we have the best education system for all learners while being inclusive, and also the other aspects of the department looking after lifelong learning.
And I guess this is where things like executive head models start coming in.
Well, that's not actually part of this review, but obviously it has come up previously amongst politicians and the wider community. Simple fact is that we, when we recruit for the head of a school, we appoint the best person who applies for that role. There has been a policy decision worked out in conjunction with the teaching unions that an executive head may be the head of up to three schools, and that it seems to be the optimum. And also an exceptional leader can bring that exceptional leadership for the benefit of all the schools within their portfolio, and it also enables additional funding to be invested in enabling other teachers to step up to be head of school in those individual places, and also any additional budget to be reinvested within those schools. So it really is a positive for the schools that have had a head of more than one school appointed. But equally, there are many different schools serving different communities, and we are very aware when we are undertaking the review that we need to find the best system of education, investing the most in those individual schools. And one thing that has been achieved is the adjustment to the budgeting for schools. So that is put into the schools and is for them to spend as they need to invest along the year. And that has been very welcome, I think, by the teaching professionals.
And whilst executive head isn't necessarily part of the report that you were making a statement on, I suppose it does reflect the an innovative approach to how schools are run on the island. Is there anything actually that was recommended that the department is going to implement?
Absolutely. There's, because of the resources, we've mainly got business analyst, project manager, part-time from Cabinet Office, so there's been no additional staff, if you like, taken on, but we haven't got quite the full allocation that we required to be able to deliver all aspects of the review and the various work streams. So one aspect that is personally disappointing that we haven't been able to initiate would be the additional education needs review. And there's also a wider one over the school meals operating review. However, it's a priority of mine and the department that we review the school meals that are delivered in our primary schools. I'm very grateful to the many parents and students across primary and secondary who've responded to a survey on school meals that has been running, and we will hopefully be able to make revisions and improvements to the school meals within primary to achieve the ambitions of this small part of work, piece of work, and that is to increase the local produce in our primary school meals, to reduce the food waste, but and more importantly, to reduce ultra-processed food content. And that is a very important thing, hopefully will come forward while we wait for a bigger strategic review, if you like, of the operational delivery. But the other many streams, work streams,
well,
that we...
Before we move on to the others, additional educational needs, I mean, that has been a growing issue for schools around the island. Some would say it's sort of exponential, the growth in this area. What's the likelihood of the department being able to fully address this in the not too distant future?
Well, as I said in my speech, we have established a steering group to ensure the actions that are outlined in our inclusive education policy are effectively carried out. And that work is very much underway. But the bigger inclusive education review must wait until we have the appropriate people resourced to undertake. That is, as you say, is fundamental to the future of our inclusive education system. And we are very much committed to it. But in the meantime, obviously, we are keen that the policy is underway, and I'm pleased to be able to report that the special education needs coordinators, we've had a much improved access to training and professional development for those over the past years, and I hope to see that will continue.
And is it a much bigger problem now than it was, or is it just perhaps that it was underreported in the past?
No, I think as you've heard from the evidence that we gave to the dyslexia, dyscalculia committee that has been set up to look at provision within our schools, there are many, there's very much an increase in the proportion of our children who are presenting with some form of additional need. We actually have 25% within our schools, which is higher than neighbouring jurisdictions. I think it's 23% in Scotland, but only 8% in Wales and somewhere in between in England. So we do identify, but we have very much an increasing demand with children coming with very complex medical needs as well. We have obviously noticed a decrease in the children overall on the roll in primary schools of over 350 students in the 4 years. I think it was from 2020 to 2024. But while there was a decrease of 350, there was an increase in demand of 100 of children with additional
need. And likewise, instead of seeing any corresponding reduction in staffing, we saw actually an increase of over 100 staff to meet the need of those additional needs. So this is all part of why we have to have quite significant reviews of the educational delivery in order to see that we are meeting the needs of all those that we are statutorily obliged to deliver education to. But the other pieces that came out of that funding review are significant as well. For instance, looking at CCTV, securing school access, and various focuses, including delivery models for key support services. So, for instance, centralising school lettings, caretaking, cleaning, with the aim to identify more efficient ways of delivering all those for all our schools.
That was GARF MHK Daphne Kane. So what do you think? Is the Education Minister right to reject a possible £3 million saving by streamlining primary education and closing smaller schools? Or is the smaller school's value much greater than the potential savings? Should the Isle of Man be bolder in making its view known on the international stage? Or is caution a better policy? Are we doing enough to help mitigate against the likely impact of climate change? It would certainly appear not, based on this year's report. Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting philgorn@manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. I'm Phil Gorn. Thanks for listening.